And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm happy to welcome Bill Lofilm back to the program. Bill made a splash with two standalone crime novels, Bloodroot and Fresh Kills. 2011 saw character Maureen Coughlan debut in The Devil She Knows. 2013 brought us The Devil in Her Way, and Sarah Crichton Books has just published the third installment of the series, Doing the Devil's Work. Bill, the last time you were on Book Talk for the first book in the Maureen Coughlan series, The Devil She Knows, the book was a thriller where Maureen was a cocktail waitress on Staten Island who saw something she wasn't supposed to see. But the next two books, her life has changed drastically. What's going on in her life now?
Well, she has changed locations, found a profession, found a career. She moved to New Orleans and she became a police officer. Well, she decided to become a police officer first by the end of The Devil She Knows. And then she decided to move to make a change, to try and get away from the things that had happened in the first book.
So why did she pick New Orleans?
I think she felt it was a place that was simpatico with her. She was looking around for another city. New Orleans was recruiting police officers. It's a department in disarray, and she felt that she would have opportunities there. And she just saw something of herself in the city.
She's kind of a hard charger, and it's kind of a laid-back town. Where does she see that?
Well, in the recovery. The books are set about 5 years after the storm, and you know she's been traumatized from the events of the first book and is trying to bounce back. And I think she sees a city that's trying to do that, that's been traumatized and is trying to bounce back. And she just felt like it was her kind of place.
And so what was your decision to move from Staten Island down to New Orleans all about?
It was a lot less dramatic. I'd been to New Orleans to visit a couple of times and just really liked it. There was something about the place that call to me, which I've heard is not a new phenomenon. And 3 years after my first visit, I was there.
And some of the accents actually sound familiar down there, don't they?
They do, yeah. It's kind of stunning. There's an Irish Channel accent that sounds like just like a New York accent.
The second book in the series was different. The first one was a normal person in peril type of thriller. The second one is a book about a rookie cop experience. And this newest one seems more kind of like a puzzle mystery type of book.
That's true. I think the big change from the first to the second was in the first she's kind of acted upon. In the second, she has powers as an actor, being a police officer, which is a different situation for her. She has some power and she's in a position to try and defend people who are powerless, which is new for her. And then in the most recent book, yeah, it's more of a puzzle, both finding her way around the inner workings of the department, the bureaucracy of the city, the geography of the city. There are a couple of different nefarious forces at work that she eventually finds out are working in concert, and she's got to sort them out.
With the titles of the first two books, The Devil She Knows, The Devil in Her Way, you kind of have this solitary force set up as like the opposition in the book. But doing the devil's work, that kind of shifts the focus of what's going on, it seems like.
It does. It reveals the fact that basically everybody in the book has some kind of hustle going on. Everybody in the book is moving in some kind of gray area, either professionally, morally, ethically, legally. So everybody's doing a bit of the devil's work, which is why I like the title. There's no clear-cut good guys and no clear-cut bad guys.
So it kind of seems similar to New York in that regard.
Similar to New York. I feel that's how New Orleans is. I feel that's how most, if not all, cities are, especially city bureaucracies and city agencies like police departments. And there's some talk of the sheriff's department and the hospital system and the system for dealing with or not dealing with homelessness and mental illness on the street. And everybody's cheating a little bit, either to look out for themselves or to try and look out for other people in a system that's dysfunctional.
So what's your hustle down in New Orleans?
Trying to make a living on books.
How the hell do you do that?
You squeeze through. I've done some bartending on the side, too, which is its own brand of hustle.
Sorry, are you still attending bar now?
Not at the moment. Right now, I'm out of it. I'm touring this book, and I'm trying to write the next one. And that's pretty much – those two things are pretty much all-consuming right now. Play a little music, and that's about it.
So has Sarah Crichton trying to get you up your output to a one-a-year schedule, or are you going to stick with one every other year?
I think we're going to try and get back on a one a year. This book is due late spring, early summer of this year. I think they want to hang on to it for about a year before they put it out. So I guess first half of 16 is what we're looking at right now for the next book.
So in the second book, her field training officer was a sergeant named Preacher, and he's still in the third book because he's the supervising sergeant for the 6th Precinct.
Yeah, he becomes her duty sergeant for the night watch. He still gets to keep an eye on her, even though their interaction is not as direct, and she's still answerable to him, even though she's out of training now.
How can they put a rookie on the night watch out there on her own? Because it seems like that would be kind of like a more dangerous time.
It would. That's the way she prefers it. It's also the department is so depleted right now that everybody goes where they're needed, and that's pretty much how it goes. And solo patrols are a regular thing. Most cops are out there by themselves at night during the day, no matter what neighborhood they're in.
Doing the Devil's Work picks up, what, about 3 months after the last book?
Yeah, about that. I think it's August in The Devil and Her Way, and then we're into October, I think.
So are you going to keep things fairly tight in the series, or are you going to try to get her to age in real time for the later books?
A little bit of both. The one I'm working on right now is, again, a few weeks after doing The Devil's Work, and then should be able to wrap that up into a nice little three-piece story. And then I'm anticipating some kind of time jump, maybe 6 months or a year, between the book I'm writing now and the book after that.
Now, with The Devil in Her Way and doing The Devil's Work, they're not necessarily books about a certain circumstance. It's just more of like a period of Maureen's life, because there is some lack of resolution among major points. And I know in a continuing series, that's a good thing. But also you can look at it as that this is about Maureen. This is not necessarily about the crimes necessarily.
Yes, that's true. It's character-driven, and she's the character that drives it, even though there are certain other characters like Preacher who reappear from book to book. But it's really Maureen's story, and it's the story of someone finding their purpose and finding their place. Her purpose and place just happens to be being a police officer in New Orleans. They are character books more than they are like whodunits or puzzle books.
How are women writers and women readers reacting to you writing across gender?
Very, very well. This book especially, actually, has gotten a lot of praise from critics and from other authors. You know, I've had a number of other authors reach out to me and tell me how authentic it feels and what a compelling character she is, and that you get to spend some time with her psychologically and emotionally that you don't normally see in the genre, and that you especially don't normally see for women in the genre.
What do you attribute your ability to get that done effectively?
To think of her first and foremost as a person and as an individual. It's a character I've been working with a long time. I did a lot of work with her before. I wrote a novel about her before that novel was published. So I know her really well. And just to think of her as a unique individual and a unique personality and ask myself in situations, what would Maureen do? And not think, what would a woman do? Or even what would a cop do? Or just what would Maureen do based on who she is? It seems to work. It seems to translate.
Do you remember the first sentences you wrote about Maureen?
Not the first sentences. The very first piece I wrote about her before she even had her name. This was when I was still living in New York. I was at a stoplight on Staten Island, and I saw in the middle of the day, and I saw a woman in a tuxedo standing on a bus stop. And I was just wondering what she was doing in the middle of the day wearing a tuxedo on a bus stop. And I figured she must be a waitress in a local diner. And just as an experiment, I tried to pick a short period of time and see how much of her story I could tell. So basically her walk from her apartment to the bus stop was the first like short story featuring that character. And she grew from there. And she appeared in the novel I used as my graduate school thesis and in some short stories and under a different name and slightly different circumstances. And eventually she became who she is when I sat down to write a book about her.
On the force, she's got 3 strikes against her. She's not from there. She's from New York. She is a woman, and she's a rookie.
It's very difficult circumstances. And the circumstances probably matter in the order that you name them. It matters very much where you're from. There's a whole hierarchy, I'm sure not just in the police department, but I know in the city of where are you from? Are you from New Orleans? Were you born there? How long have you been there? And now these days,
which high school did you go to?
That's always the question when people ask you where you went to school. It's not college, it's high school. And now another level of the hierarchy is, were you there before the storm or did you arrive after? and how long after. So that's even like a fourth strike in that she came after the storm.
And so how are you seeing the gentrification now in the rebuilding years?
I mean, in a way, it's a good thing. I noticed maybe 2 years ago, the arguments people were having started to change from how to manage the recovery to basic city issues, gentrification, bike lanes, green space, housing, home prices, traffic, you know, condition of the roads, things like that. The argument shifted away from how to spend recovery money and how's the recovery going and rebuilding the city to concerns of normal cities, which I think ultimately is a good thing. The idea that we were going to build it back into a city that didn't have any problems was fantastical. That's never going to happen, especially that place. But I mean, I think it's going well. The city, you know, the city's booming. The city has its problems. Some of the traditionally affordable neighborhoods are getting expensive. There's a lot of out-of-town money coming in. There's some resentment that people who came back after the storm and toughed it out in 06, 07, 08, when things were really bad, are getting now priced out of their neighborhoods by people arriving in 11, 12, 13. There's a little bit of that kind of resentment going on. But overall, I mean, the city is growing. And then having been on tour for this book and going to other cities, I know there are some concerns that New Orleans is becoming too much like New York, or in another direction, New Orleans is becoming too much like Houston. Or I don't think those concerns are founded. We just don't have the space to be Houston. You know, we can't sprawl. You know, you run it, you end up in either the Gulf, the river, or the lake. But, you know, there's a lot going on.
Well, it's always that tension of preserving character but also being able to grow and evolve, because you can't just be a little jewel box that never changes.
That's true. One of the things I like about New Orleans, it's not a city where there's one little section of town where we recreate the history. You go down to a club and you'll see someone playing Tin Pan Alley Blues, and they've been playing Tin Pan Alley Blues continually in New Orleans since the days of Tin Pan Alley. It's not like something that was brought back as a novelty or as a tourist attraction. It's a living thing that happens. And fortunately, there's a really strong historical preservation infrastructure. And the city and the city government is really cognizant of preserving. There's too much of a tendency to let things fall down. There is, I think, a good impulse to be wary of tearing things down.
We see that in the books with the character of Marcus, who is involved integrally in the second book. And he's a young teenager who's involved in a brass band project that is supposed to help kids off the streets.
The Roots of Music, yeah, which is a real thing. I use it fictionally in the book. To me, it's one of the great things to come after the storm, which it's a citywide marching band for kids in New Orleans, middle school, younger. I forget where you age out. I forget if it's 15 or 18, or I think it might be 15. But they teach the kids to play. They teach them how to march, bus them. They feed them. They help them with their homework. It's using the best of New Orleans to raise up the people who might otherwise be struggling and who are still struggling. I just think it's a really great thing. They've marched in the Thanksgiving Day Parade in New York. They've marched in the Tournament of Roses Parade. They've been all over the country, and it gives these kids all kinds of opportunities. In fact, for one of the book signings in New Orleans, we had the drum line from Roots come and practice some of the marching cadences that Marcus would be learning and demonstrate the things that he would be learning as part of Roots in the book.
So you're a drummer yourself. Would you match up well, or would they laugh at you?
They would absolutely laugh at me. So much of New Orleans drumming, especially like the second line beats, are all out of marching band playing. And that's my one regret, or one of my regrets about high school, is that I did not join the marching band and do not how to play marching band drums, which is an essential part of real New Orleans drumming. And I really can't do that.
So how do you make do in your band?
You fake it. I've picked up enough.
Watch a few Stanton Moore videos.
I spent a lot of time listening to, yeah, Stanton is one of my favorites. Herlin Riley is another one. Just some of the jazz drummers. And you just, hopefully, I've been there almost 20 years, and hopefully I've just absorbed just enough funk to get by. But yeah, I mean, there are things these kids can do that I'm never going to know. Like, I could never be a snare drummer in a brass band like Marcus.
You don't have the wrist for it?
I don't. It's a whole way of thinking and using your hands that at my age, I don't know if I could learn.
Now, the action in the new book kicks off when Maureen catches a call about a dead body in a bad neighborhood.
Which happens. I think especially being on the street, being a patrol officer, I think those are the kind of things you run into. You spend a fair amount of time dealing with the residue of crime, the after effects.
And so she gets there. It's kind of a – looks like a vacant house. There's a white guy in a predominantly African-American neighborhood dead. So this raises a lot of questions.
It does. You know, why he would be there, why he would be in that abandoned house, which you learn when you read the book, the neighborhood knows is abandoned, has actually been trying to get the house taken care of. And so it's a really odd set of circumstances under which for a body like that to end up in a house like that. So there are a lot of things about that situation that don't add up.
Now, there's a homicide detective named Atkinson, who we met in the second book, and she catches the case and she comes down to the scene. And she is what Maureen aspires to be. She's very much a role model for Maureen.
Yes, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons she's named Atkinson. Is she's named after Kate Atkinson, the author whose Jackson Brody series is kind of one of my aspirational targets. I don't know if you've read it, but it's just, oh, it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. She's such a great writer. And so anyway, yeah, I thought it would be good to give Maureen a clear visual and give the reader a clear visual of what she wanted and how she sees herself potentially. You know, Atkinson is experienced and she's tough and she's smart and she's respected and she's very, very good at what she does. And those are all the things that Maureen wants to be. And so she feels a little bit of like, you know, the puppy running after the big dog when she works with Atkinson, which is a new feeling for Maureen.
But she also needs to get a handle on her temper. And it seems like no amount of people telling her that has made it happen yet.
No, it's a real challenge for her. I mean, you know, she's about 30. She's been a cocktail waitress since she was 18. She has been kind of overlooked or pushed around for the majority of her adult life, and now all of a sudden she has a little bit of power. And she has some issues. She has some issues with her temper, with her anger, with her past. The combination of those issues and this power that she has is volatile, and it's a challenge for her.
So when you're writing this character, how much do you think in your setting how she evolves is organic, or how much of it is you need to get her to this point to make her different?
Well, I want her to have some kind of professional arc and personal arc, and I want her to have relationships. And her relationships are not going to grow and change unless she does. So there's a certain amount of, you know, pushing or nudging her along that I have to do. And there's also the organic side of her, for once in her life, having a clear vision of who and what she wants to be, and then learning her own limitations as far as being able to get there. So that tension is very organic. You know, this is what I want to do. This is where I'm at right now. How do I learn and grow in order to get to the place I want to be?
So how much conflict do you see in her that, you know, she now has to enforce laws, especially about drugs, and she herself, you know, in the restaurant and bar business, if there isn't a little stimulant there, it's really hard to get through a lot of shifts.
Her attitude is somewhat like other cops in that don't be dumb enough to get caught. There's a difference, at least in her mind, between a couple of bumps to get through a bar shift and, you know, running it across town. And there's definitely a potential for hypocrisy on her part between, you know, this is what I used to do to get by, but I'm a cop now, and so I'm not necessarily going to look the other way when you're doing what you need to do to get by. So, yeah, there's definitely conflict, and, you know, she's human, and I think we're all capable of a certain level of hypocrisy, and she certainly is too.
Well, and she sees kind of the way Preacher can deal with people on the streets, that there is a little bit of slack that needs to be cut in the day-to-day policing of a community.
One of the things I think Preacher tries to teach her is you think of the long game. In the second book, there's an informant they work with, a guy named Little E, one of Preacher's informants. And Preacher cuts him breaks in order to keep him close and be able to A, keep a guy who has never really done anything that terrible, try and keep him out of the system, and B, you know, establish a relationship where when something truly bad happens, maybe this guy will be helpful instead of being an enemy. So one of the things Preacher tries to teach Maureen is to think several steps down the road and think ahead, and giving somebody a hard time now going to hurt you down the road.
Back at that crime scene at the beginning of the book, the victim is wearing a belt buckle that says 88, and it's not because he's a Dale Earnhardt Jr. fan.
No, it's not. It's funny. The character has no role in the book other than to be dead. You find out later that he was a fugitive. And also, the number 88 is significant to white supremacists because H is the eighth letter of the alphabet. And so 88 is HH or Heil Hitler. And you find out this guy has a history as a white supremacist.
Taking 88 as a symbol is just as dumb as white supremacists are. It just seems so stupid.
Well, yeah, I mean, it points to the immaturity that comes with a lot of that, that comes with that mindset where, ooh, it's a secret code, but it's such an obvious code, and then I'm going to wear it on a belt buckle or a T-shirt or a tattoo to make sure everybody still knows what I'm talking about.
You link it to what is called the sovereign citizen movement. And
yes.
You even mentioned a horrible shooting that happened in West Memphis a couple of years ago as well.
Yeah, I was looking for an existential threat. The crime series that I really like, the idea of the existential threat, the ongoing, continuing threat to police officers or public safety or cities, you know, is always present. So I was looking for a group or something that was a larger threat. And I didn't want to do like the Klan, or even though it opens with someone who is a white supremacist, white supremacy, or just that. Or so I discovered this group called the Sovereign Citizens, who are people who don't believe in the power of the federal government and have this whole complex system of beliefs that generally liberates them from getting any kind of license or permit or permission or paying taxes or fines or fees, or it's a very self-serving ethos. They have a history of violence against law enforcement, especially ambush tactics like what happened in West Memphis. There was a shootout in LaPlace, Louisiana, where a couple of officers were killed. And I just thought it was one of those things that once I discovered it, couldn't believe wasn't getting more attention. Like, it reminded me of, in 1998, I got a copy of Esquire magazine that had a picture of Osama bin Laden on the cover. And it said, "Greetings, America, I'm Osama bin Laden, and I'm here to kill you." And I've read the article, and I was like, how is this guy not dead already? You know, by the time I get, why is he not all over the news? Why are we not paying more attention? And I had a similar feeling when I started reading about the sovereign citizens. And there was just a report this week on CNN that actually Homeland Security considers them the great existential threat to law enforcement. And the number one terrorist threat in the United States is domestic terror. You know, Timothy McVeigh was a sovereign citizen.
And you go back to kind of like the Posse Comitatus guys,
yeah,
back in the 70s
and
80s.
Yeah, it goes all the way back there. Yeah. Clive and Bundy was another one. So it was just one of those things that there was more to it the deeper I looked into it. And it wasn't getting a whole lot of attention, so I thought it made for a real... And it is more complex than simple racial hatred, although that seems to be a part of it. There's no mystery to the fact that movements like this exploded when Obama was elected president.
And so the New Orleans police are kind of caught in the middle because they have the local criminal element, and that kind of violence is more situational. But the sovereign citizens are aiming purposefully to hunt police officers.
Yes, and are trying to use the local criminal element to their advantage. So you have the New Orleans police in the book trying to deal with the day-to-day tasks they always do, and now with this new threat moving into the city that's coming after them specifically.
And of course, you know, she's a beat cop, essentially, mm-hmm. and she's not going to work one crime all the way through. She's just going to take crimes as they come up and along. She's still dealing with Marcus and his grandmother because there's their existential threat of Bobby Scales, the drug dealer. He's still out
right.
and about. I mean, she's doing traffic stops, too. And she pulls over a redneck named Clayton Gage.
She does, who has a passenger. It's a woman named Madison Leary with him. It was one of those things that I've heard from numerous police officers where you just develop an instinctual eye for what Maureen calls is the anomaly. When things catch your attention when they appear where they don't belong, when they don't belong. And
Sesame Street taught us that.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I think in the book, that's what Preacher calls it, that one of these things is not like the other, the Sesame Street rule. And so that leads her to pull over the pickup truck, and it's a confrontational stop where she has to flex a little bit to get things to go her way.
And she's especially concerned for the female passenger, Madison Leary, because she doesn't seem sober. And she thinks that Gage might be predatory.
Yeah. One of the Maureen's instincts that benefits her as a police officer, she has a sense for the predatory men especially. And this guy Clayton kind of sets off that alarm, especially Madison's a small woman like Maureen. She's incoherent. She seems to be high or troubled in some way. And so Maureen instantly suspects something no good is not only unfolding, but that something worse was coming up and that she's interrupted what could have been a much more serious crime than the crime she uncovers.
And so she calls for help, and Preacher shows up, and also other beat cops from the 6th, Quinn and Ruiz, show up too.
Yes. Quinn and Ruiz are the first two cops that she works with regularly that she's developing a relationship with. While Preacher kind of demonstrates what you could call the right way to massage the rules, Quinn and Ruiz demonstrate maybe the wrong way to massage the rules, or work outside of the constraints of the job.
Because so, they're looking more for personal benefit, at least a lack of trouble for them, as opposed to doing what's best for the community.
Yeah, they're keep it simple in the 6th. You know, that's what Quinn says. Everything is about how much hassle he's going to end up with and minimizing that hassle, whether or not it's the right thing to do.
The most interesting character we get to meet in the book, the girl Dice, who's one of the homeless, what they call gutter punks.
Yes. She's one of those characters who kind of elbowed her own way into the story. You know, she appears very briefly in The Devil in Her Way and then reappears in this book and was looking for an opportunity to use her. And she earns herself some increased page time. She's really fun character. She's really sharp. She's streetwise. She's tough. She's been living on the street. You know, some mysterious things about her. She spends a lot of time talking about the other people that she knows on the street, not a lot of time talking about herself.
Well, she makes bad decisions with that big dragon tattoo.
Yeah, I know a lot of street kids who have made bad decisions about tattoos.
And a character we get to know in the new book that we don't like is Detective Drayton.
Yes. If Atkinson is like the Uber Maureen, then Drayton is somewhat like the Uber Quinn. He's kind of the connected detective who knows how to play the game, knows how to play the political game in the department, and so has managed to endure it. And the guy who manages to have a lot of nice suits and get a lot of attention as a detective, despite the fact he never really solves a whole lot of crimes. And I think that's true in any bureaucracy. You know, there are the people who don't seem to accomplish a whole lot, yet seem to move up through the ranks and have these long careers where they accomplish very little.
While Maureen's beat usually involves more impoverished neighborhoods, at the original crime scene, she gets to meet the upper crust of New Orleans when the owner of the rental property where the body is found, Caleb Heath, shows up, and he doesn't seem really concerned that there's a dead person in one of his properties.
As long as he's not going to get blamed for it, he doesn't have much concern for anything really other than himself. He's basically a slumlord. He's a rich guy's son who, again, like Drayton, has never really done a whole lot, and his father has put him in charge of managing these rental properties to try and teach him some kind of responsibility and business, and he's just not rising to the task.
So we see malfeasance on three levels. We see just everyday street crime. We see kind of corruption in official bureaucracy. And then we see the corruption of wealth.
Absolutely. I mean, these are the things you have to contend with. And especially in one of the reasons I put Maureen in the 6th District, even though I expand the borders of it somewhat for the book, it encompasses all different kinds of neighborhoods. You know, from the Irish Channel to the Garden District, which is one of the wealthiest neighborhoods in the city, to Central City, which is one of the least wealthy neighborhoods in the city. And they're all incorporated in this one district. So she literally moves from one world to another, you know, as she patrols. and as she deals with different people. And unfortunately, crime scenes are where these different groups intersect.
So how does a person live in New Orleans and not get completely overwhelmed and frustrated by kind of the problems that are there? I guess the positives make up for it.
They do. You know, the day-to-day life is so rich and beautiful. And like we had on my corner, I live on the intersection of 3rd and Magazine Streets. And Magazine is a major commercial street. And there was a sinkhole appeared at that corner. The Magazine Street just collapsed. And so the city had to tear it up, and they found out it was a sewer line because the water and sewer systems were 100 years old. And so they have it all torn up, and the road crew is out there all weekend. I mean, you've never heard a bunch of guys have a better time digging up the street, you know, all day and all night than these guys, laughing and singing and, you know, arguing and yelling at each other. I mean, it sounds like a block party. You know, and they dug down there and they figured out what the problem was and they fixed it and they patched it up and took maybe 2 days. You know, people were worried it was going to be closed for weeks. And, you know, but I walked past, I turned that corner with the dogs and they're laughing and hitting each other. And there's just a, I don't know, there's just a joy. There's such a ready access to joy in that city that I've never found anywhere else. And its problems are city problems. The poverty, crime, corruption. If you have it here in Memphis, it's in New York, it's in Dallas, Houston, Austin, any Texas city in any state.
So do you have a title picked out for the fourth one yet?
The working title is Let the Devil Out. We'll see whether or not that hangs on.
So does the story go along with that theme of the title?
Yes. A lot of stuff gets let loose that's been built up over the first couple of books.
Well, Bill, I want to thank you so much for stopping by and sharing the new book with us.
Oh, thanks for having me back on, man. It was good to be here.
Bill Lofilm is the author of Doing the Devil's Work, which is available from Sarah Crichton Books. I'm Stephen Usery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com. Or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111. Or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.